Well, last month anyway, we read about God repeating his Sabbath commands in Exodus chapter 31. Let's go there. Let's go right to Exodus 31. And as we know, this was right when he was given his instructions for building the tent tabernacle in Exodus chapter 31. And today, let's go back to Exodus 31. Let's just begin where we left off last time, and let's go over the verses in Exodus, the Sabbath verses in Exodus 31, and then continue from there. So Exodus 31 and verse 12, "And the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, Speak you also unto the children of Israel, saying, Verily, my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Eternal that does sanctify you." So it's a sign between Yahweh and you and me, brethren, between Jesus Christ and you and me. "You shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy unto you. Everyone that defiles it shall surely be put to death." That's serious, brethren. "For whosoever does any work, malaka therein, that soul, that life shall be cut off. That life shall be cut off from among his people. 6 days may work be done, but in the seventh is the Sabbath of rest." Shabbat, Shabbathon is the Hebrew there. Shabbat, Shabbathon, Sabbath of rest. "Holy to the Eternal. Whosoever does any work, any malaka, in the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death." Repeats that again. Serious warning repeated, brethren. "Wherefore the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations for a perpetual covenant." And last month, brethren, I omitted verse 17. I'll correct that omission now. Let's read verse 17. "It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. Forever. For in 6 days the Eternal made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested." He Shabbathed, brethren, with one B. He Shabbathed. "And was refreshed." And the Hebrew word there is nafash, which means he took a breather. Now this verse 17 actually doubles up on the concept and the aspects of the sign between God and us, and the forever aspect, the eternal aspect of Sabbath keeping. That as long as Israel exists, then we'll be required to keep the Sabbath. And we are... We believe that we are the remnants of physical Israel, and we believe that we are spiritual Israel in God's true church, brethren. Okay, again, this doubles up, this verse doubles up on the sign and the forever aspects of Sabbath keeping, as previously mentioned in verses 13 and 16. Now let's continue. And let's follow Israel, the children of Israel, as they progress in time order. Let's see what they're doing here as we flip through. We'll just flip through a couple of chapters here. In Exodus chapter 32, "While Moses was still upon Mount Sinai receiving God's holy law," what were the Israelites doing? They were busy building an idolatrous golden calf. Can you believe it, brethren, after all that they'd seen, after all that they'd experienced? How soon we forget. We're going to see that today as we go along. And of course, when Moses learned about this, he got pretty mad. He got pretty mad. And he got pretty hot there, and he smashed the two stone tablets that God had given him. Now in chapter 33, the Eternal Yahweh commanded the Israelites to prepare to leave Sinai, and he promised his continued presence with them as they went through. And then, in chapter 34, let's go over to chapter 34, before they left Sinai, the Eternal Yahweh told Moses to make a new set of stone tablets to replace the ones that he'd broken in anger. And he, the Lord, repeated his covenant with Israel, and he also repeated some commandments and statutes that he'd given before, and he actually repeated this commandment as well, the fourth commandment. Exodus chapter 34 and verse 21. 6 days shall you work. Sorry, 6 days you shall work, and the word is not malaka this time. It's a different Hebrew word, abad, but it has the same, has basically the same types of work, all different various types of work. 6 days you shall work, but on the seventh day you shall rest. You shall Shabbat with one B. In earing time and in harvest you shall rest. You shall Shabbat. And of course, the last part of this verse couldn't be put into practice for quite a few years until the Israelites arrived in the Promised Land and were able to grow crops. So when they would have the earing time and the harvest. However, as we've already seen, and we can't say, well, they hadn't arrived yet, so they really didn't have to keep the Sabbath. Of course they did. And God's referring more to times there. And again, we'll see as we go through that God's command for them to rest was fully in force while they were still on the road, while they were still on the move. Okay, and then we come to chapter 35. And as chapter 35 begins, and just before he gives them a lengthy set of instructions for giving offerings, he tells them, I need some stuff here to build a new tabernacle. I need the materials for the new tabernacle that was going to be built. And we need to keep that context, brethren, in mind as we go through chapter 35. The Lord repeats his Sabbath commands yet again, and even expands on them. And brethren, it appears that he, the Lord God Yahweh, he needed to keep reminding the Israelites frequently. And he seemed to know that if he didn't keep reminding them, that they'd slack off from keeping it properly, and perhaps that they'd slack off from keeping it at all. And if you look around us in the world, how many people on your street, I look up and down the cul-de-sac here, and who is keeping the Sabbath in Israel nowadays? It's really not that many, even the Jews. I'd go as far as to say, I'd be interested to find out how many of the modern day Jews keep the Sabbath, I won't even say properly, I'd say at all. And again, brethren, why do we modern day spiritual Israelites feel that we're so very different from them? Because we have short memories too, and we need frequent reminders. And really that's what this Bible study is all about. Okay, Exodus chapter 35 and verse 1. And remember, this is just before he gives this information about the offerings that he needed for the gold and the silver and all of the hardware that he needed for the building of the tabernacle. Exodus chapter 35 and verse 1. And Moses gathered all the congregation of the children of Israel together and said unto them, these are the words, and the Hebrew word is dabar, D-A-B-A-R, and it can mean an alternative is commandments. So these are the words or the commandments which the Eternal has commanded, that you should do them. We have to be doers, brethren. We can't just look at it and say, well, you know, my heart's right. You know, we have to do them. 6 days shall work be done. Malacca, shall work be done, brethren. How many of us don't have work to do? You know, I've been retired for 10 years. I've never been so busy in all my life. You know, there's work to do. Our kids have got work to do. You know, the people who are out with day jobs have work to do, of course, but that's not all. 6 days shall work, melacha, be done, but on the seventh day there shall be to you a holy day, a holy day. This is holy time, brethren. This is God's holy time, a Sabbath of rest. Again, Shabbat, Shabbaton, to the eternal. And whosoever does work, melacha, therein shall be put to death. And there it is again. There's that major warning from God, brethren. Repeated warning. And over again, he gives that warning. And no Israelite at that time could complain. And they know, they've seen what God could do. They've seen what God did to the Egyptians. And not one Israelite could complain that he had not been warned. And again, brethren, we proved last time, we looked at Exodus chapter 12 and verse 16, and we looked at the word malacha, and we know that it's not only, as some people claim, that it's the, you know, it's only day job work. No, it can also include various kinds of work, including work that is expended in cooking and other food preparation. And Exodus chapter 12, 16 proves that without a shadow of a doubt. Okay, now let's look at, now comes an added stipulation. This is a really interesting one. Verse 3, you shall kindle no fire throughout your habitations upon the Sabbath day. This is interesting. The word for kindle is bahar. It's not like a sheep going bahar. But it's B-A-hyphen-A-R, bahar. You shall kindle no fire throughout your habitations upon the Sabbath day. Let's examine this a little bit. This is an added requirement here, and it might sound a little bit harsh. We think about what it was like where they were at the time. They were up on kind of a plateau of Sinai that went up to Mount Sinai. And in modern times anyway, I looked on the internet there, and the average winter nighttime temperatures in that area, they're a little bit higher than ours here on the west coast of North America. They can drop into the mid 40s Fahrenheit, about 8 or 9 Celsius in the winter, and that's not freezing, but it's still quite cool. And we know that freezing temperatures and snow certainly do happen on occasion, the same as they do here. So, and especially upon those upper levels where they were, so it could get pretty cool. And remember that at that time, the Israelites were not living in houses with air conditioning and nice heaters like you and I have. They were living in tents. They were living in tents and other kinds of temporary dwellings, maybe covered wagons and that kind of thing is how I visualize it. So, talking about, it says, you shall kindle no fire throughout your habitations on the Sabbath day. Throughout your habitation, I don't believe that it means inside your tents, but I believe that it rather means all through the camp, all through the camp. The ancient Israelites occasionally did some pretty dumb things, from pretty stupid things, just like their modern descendants, but it's very unlikely that they would ever risk lighting fires inside their tents. Right, but so it's more likely that the usual purposes for their fires, the Israelites' fires, would be similar to those for which we today would light fires, okay, on a recreational camping trip, for instance, or for cooking and for warming ourselves, right? All right, now, but again, let's go back to the context of this verse, because it really gets interesting. It could be referring more specifically to the fires that were necessary for the tabernacle construction work. For instance, the melting and the working with the gold, the silver, the brass and the bronze. And this is strongly alluded to in an excerpt from John Gill's commentary. I don't know whether you're familiar with John Gill, but he's very conservative in many ways, and he's very thorough. It's not like he doesn't give just one or two lines on a verse. He really digs into it. Now, I don't agree with everything he says on this particular verse, and I don't solidly believe that his opinion agrees 100% with God's word, but it does. His comments do shed some light on the topic. I'm going to read some of it for you. So again, this is from John Gill's commentary on, Exodus 35 and verse 3. He says, "This law seems to be a temporary one, and not to be continued, nor is it said to be throughout their generations as elsewhere, where the law of the Sabbath is given or repeated." Again, I'm not totally sure that he's right there, but anyway, he continues, "It is to be restrained or restricted to the building of the tabernacle, and while that was about to which it is prefaced, and it is designed to prevent all public or private working on the Sabbath day in anything belonging to that." In other words, specifically the tabernacle building work. "Having no fire to heat their tools or melt their metal or do anything for which that was necessary." And then he says, "For it can hardly be thought that this is to be taken in the strictest sense as an entire prohibition of kindling a fire and the use of it on that day," Sabbath day, "which is so absolutely useful and needful in various cases, and where acts of mercy and necessity require it, as in the cold seasons of the year, for the warming and comforting of persons who otherwise would be unfit for religious exercises, and on the account of infants and aged persons who could not subsist without it, and in cases of sickness and various disorders which necessarily require it." Fair enough. In other words, what he's saying is he doesn't think that having a fire was prohibited on a permanent, ongoing basis. Okay. "And yet this law," he says, "is interpreted by them," talking about the Jews, "in the most rigorous sense. They put kindling a fire among the principal works forbidden on that day, and that not only to bake bread and boil flesh, but to warm themselves with." So the Jews, at least of that time, said, "No, you can't light a fire." Nay, he says, I don't know when John Gill lived, but he uses some old English terminology. "They think it unlawful to touch a hearth, or a coal of fire, or a firebrand, or anything that could give them any warmth on the cold season. And if, for the sake of infants or aged persons, there is a need of a fire or heating a stove, they hire a Christian to do it, or so prepare and order matters the day before that it kindle of itself." Okay. And then he quotes another scholar, somebody by the name of Leo Modena. I'm not familiar with him at all, but he continues, and this is John Gill quoting Leo Modena. "They," the Jews, "do not meddle with any fire, nor touch any wood that is on fire, nor kindle any, nor put it out, nor do they so much as light a candle on the Sabbath day. And if the place be cold where they dwell, except they have any stoves or hot houses, or else have someone that is no Jew to kindle a fire for them, or had so ordered the matter beforehand that the fire should kindle of itself at such a time, they must even be content to sit in the cold all that day." Do we have a harsh God who would do that? I don't think so. I don't believe that God would have a problem with his people, either ancient or modern, preparing Sabbath fires prior to sunset on a Friday afternoon or evening and feeding them as the day progressed. And I'll tell you why I say that as we go along. But in our day to day, in our world today, even if you do have a house that is heated by a wood stove, we have modern ultra efficient wood stoves that can burn just a few logs and heat a house for a whole day. We were down at Walter Bond's house last week there down in Sioux, and he built himself an ultra efficient wood stove, and it'll burn for a long, long time just on the house. You know, you've got to take your jacket off because it gets so hot in there. Okay, but I don't believe that God would have a problem with his people preparing Sabbath fires before the Sabbath and feeding them as the day progressed. But I am sure that God would have a problem with his people arranging for Gentiles, either physical or spiritual, to kindle their fires in their stead. I believe that. And this reminds me actually of an email letter that I received recently, and it was on this very Sabbath food topic. And the writer was a man. He mentioned some instances of Church of God members, modern Church of God members, making reciprocal arrangements with Sunday keeping professing Christians to cook hot meals for one or another on their respective rest days. I'd never heard of it myself until this man mentioned it. It kind of blows my mind that a true Christian would do that and think that that was okay. But that's basically exactly what the Jews were doing. God clearly, brethren, tells us in a number of scriptures that there's one law which applies to all, both Israelites and Gentiles, spiritual and physical. There's only one law. The only difference is whether or not we're going to obey those laws. I'll give you a couple of scriptures on that. Exodus chapter 12 and verse 49. We won't go there. Exodus 12, 49. And Numbers chapter 15, verses 16 and 29. Just to back up that there's one law for all. Let's go back to John Gill's commentary here as he finishes off. But here they, and now he's talking about the ancient Jews, nicely distinguish and observe that it is said throughout your habitations, and they take that as being private dwellings, your private dwellings, but not the habitation of the Lord or the house of the sanctuary. And on this score, they allow of the kindling of a fire in the Beth Moked, an apartment in the temple where a fire was constantly kept for the priests that kept watch to warm themselves at. So, you know, I believe that the Jews' interpretation of throughout your dwellings to mean in all of your private homes is erroneous and possibly twisted by the priests of that time to benefit themselves and the Levites. And we wonder, have similar misinterpretations in years past, have we seen such things in the church, in the leadership of the modern day spiritual Israel? And God tells us repeatedly that he is no respecter of persons, and neither should we be. Let's take a quick look at the verb kindle here. Again, the Hebrew word is bar, and Christmas, my joke. It's not ba. But it's BA-AR, and it's Strong's 01197. Among other words, it can also be translated, and is translated in the King James Version, as burn, heated, or set. Set is the interesting one there. And the extended Hebrew meanings include these two: to begin to burn or to start burning. Right? This gets it interesting here. And when it's applied, when the word bahar is applied to fires, then the terms set, begin, and start agree most closely with the most common English meaning of the word kindle, which according to my dictionary anyway, the definition means to start, to light, or to ignite a fire, a torch, or a barbecue. And thinking about this, this would indicate that God likely did not prohibit the Israelites from having fires burning on the Sabbath day, but rather perhaps he prohibited the preparing, the setting and starting of fires during Sabbath hours. Now, my own experience of the past when we had wood stoves and fireplaces back in England, the most labor-intensive part of having a nice fire is the preparation and the setting and the starting of it. That can be quite labor-intensive. So we ask ourselves, just what is the very first prerequisite for starting a wood fire, which they had back then? And the answer is the collection of firewood. Of course it is. And this leads naturally and logically to a related scripture. Let's go over to Numbers chapter 15. And I was planning on leaving this one till we arrived in order in the book of Numbers, but I figured that this would be, because it was so closely related to these verses in Exodus 30-35, that it'd be a good time to cover it. Numbers chapter 15 and verse 32. Numbers chapter 15 and verse 32. And while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man that gathered sticks upon the Sabbath day. And evidently those sticks were for firewood. Some of the modern translations, Bible translations, actually render it as firewood. Verse 33. And they that found him gathering sticks brought him unto Moses and Aaron and unto all the congregation. And they had him put in ward, because it was not declared what should be done to him. And the Eternal said unto Moses, the man shall be surely put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones without the camp, outside the camp. And all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him with stones. And he died as the Eternal commanded Moses. Now, I've heard at least one preacher, possibly more, expressing sentiments that they felt sorry for this errant firewood collector. But those sentiments were definitely misplaced, brethren. And I'll give you three reasons why. You know, we shouldn't feel sorry for the guy, because along with all of the other Israelites, he was clearly, we've read those scriptures already today, he was clearly and repeatedly warned of the consequences over and over again. Even in the same verse, God said, shall be put to death, and shall be his soul, his life shall be cut off from God's people. He warned over and over again. And with all of God's covenants, all of God's agreements with the Israelites, God clearly says, if you do this, I'm going to do that. And that's exactly what he did in this case. The second reason is that, and this perhaps the most important reason here, is because it was the Eternal God, it was Yahweh himself who pronounced the sentence on this man. It wasn't Moses, it wasn't the people, it wasn't the man's fellow human beings, it was God himself. And who are we? Who can mere men judge the Eternal God or criticize his judgments? Does any man think that he is more righteous or merciful than our great God? And then the third reason why we shouldn't feel sorry for this guy is that if we examine the context of these verses, we'll see that this man did not commit the sin in innocence or ignorance. And if you stay in there and go back up to verse 30, these are two related verses here preceding this account. that apply to this account. Verse 30, but the soul that does out or anything presumptuously, whether he be born in the land or a stranger, again, there's one law, you know, there's a possibility that this guy could have been, you know, maybe he was a Gentile, doesn't matter. Whether he was born in the land or a stranger, there's one law. The same person reproaches the Eternal. And that soul, that life, shall be cut off from among his people. Is that warning again. Verse 31, because he has despised the word of the Eternal and has broken his commandment, that soul shall be utterly, that life shall be utterly cut off. His iniquity shall be upon him. So, just in these two verses here, this two-verse preamble to this firewood collector incident, God strongly implies that this man, first of all, acted presumptuously, which means vainly or haughtily against God. He reproached the Lord. He reproached the Eternal God, brethren. He reviled or blasphemed the Eternal God. He despised the word of the Lord. He condemned it. He disdained it. He scorned it. He treated it as contemptible, vile, or worthless. That's what that means, that despise means. He was guilty of iniquity, and he broke the Lord's commandments. All of that's in those two verses. He broke the Lord's commandments, and that means he tried to make it void. He tried to void the commandments as though, no, it didn't even exist. And, okay, we can say, and I've heard people apply that to us and say, well, I've sinned too, you know, so take me out and stone me. But, and we can ask that question. And again, as we get close to Passover, we have to be looking at ourselves, examining ourselves, and knowing that we do sin and we have sinned, and we have become worthy of the death penalty. And, you know, we ask ourselves in relation to this study, do any of us ever try to make void any part of any of God's commandments, including his Sabbath commandments? And we have to ask ourselves that question and answer honestly. Now, I don't want to stray too far or for too long from our Sabbath food context, but I want to ask the question, how must the dealing with fires and collecting firewood and all of those things, how must this be applied in our modern day? Because that's important too. Does it mean, for instance, that God's people today must stay cold on the Sabbath days in the winter months and just grin and bear it? Say, we're enjoying the Sabbath, we're rejoicing on the Sabbath. what if we have brethren living up in Alaska or up in the Yukon or the Northwest Territories? I listened to the news, the weather forecast this morning. It said in the Peace River area of BC it was minus 12 Celsius this morning. You know, icicles hanging off your nose if you didn't have a nice fire, you know, or some kind of heat. But is this what God wants? Does God in effect, does he want to punish the people who are sincerely striving to obey his commandments? No, of course he doesn't. So how can we apply it? How should we apply this in our modern day? Is it permissible for modern day spiritual Israelites like you and me, brethren, is it permissible for us to switch on a gas or electric heater on a cool Sabbath day? Of course we can. Yes, we can. It's erroneous or even ludicrous to try to equate the flicking of a switch or the turning of a thermostat dial to the laborious collection of firewood and the laborious preparation of a wood fire. Now, I've mentioned in previous sermons in this series, when you think about, you know, people say, well, there's guys working down in the power plants and the gas plants. Well, no, there isn't. Not on the Sabbath day. They're virtually fully automated And in accepting an emergency, you'd have a hard time finding a guy working down there at the power plant. So, but then we can ask another question. We can say, okay, well, if we apply this to the gas and power plants, then say, does this carry over to cooking food on God's Sabbaths? After all, there's very few people cook with solid fuel over wood fires in this day and age. And most of our modern cooking appliances are almost fully automatic. So we try to push it over into that. So, and ask that same question. And again, brethren, it's not for me to judge on these things. We asked a couple of months ago, we asked a question, can I brew a cup of coffee on the Sabbath? And some people say yes, some people say no. Can I boil water for tea, hot chocolate or instant coffee on the Sabbath? Can I make toast on the Sabbath? So these, and again, I'll repeat the same answer, brethren, that it is not for me to judge or to decide for you. What level of minor cooking, you know, and I put that in quotes, cooking may be permissible on the Sabbath, that's not for me to judge. And I defer again to our core scriptures for this series. And I'd like us to turn to them again just to burn them into our minds. Let's go to Romans chapter 14. Romans chapter 14. Probably should leave a permanent marker in our Bibles for these verses, because we're going to continue to come back to them. Romans chapter 14 and verse 23. And he that doubts is damned if he eat, because he is not of faith, for whatsoever is not of faith is sin. So we have to apply that. We've got to keep that in the back of our minds. Now let's jump over to Colossians chapter 2. And verse 16. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 16. Let no man therefore judge you in meat, or in drink, or in respect of an holy day, or of the new moon, or of the Sabbath days. So let me say to you, brethren, let no man judge you in these things. And let me ask you, please don't you judge others in these things. Please be a quiet light, as Jesus instructs, and not a noisy one. Not a noisy, there's nothing worse than a noisy light. Well, there probably are lots of things worse than a noisy light. But also, let's all heed the negative example. And these, God put these things in the Bible for our admonition, brethren. Let's heed the example, the negative example of that firewood collector there. And let's not fall into either ditch. And let's not get liberal about our Sabbath keeping. So we've finished with Exodus now. We've skipped over into Numbers a little bit. But now let's go to the book of Leviticus. We can be turning there. But the amazing thing with Leviticus, right, I think that it surprised me anyway to know that the Sabbath day, the word Sabbath is not even mentioned in the book of Leviticus until chapter 16, believe it or not. Let's turn there. And so we ask the question, what are the first 15 chapters of the book of Leviticus? What they all about? What's God talking about in there? Well, they deal with the various kinds of offerings. They deal with the beginning of the priestly ministry. They deal with the portion for Aaron's sons and the priesthood. There's a chapter there about the profane fire of Nadab and Abihu, which we're going to mention in a minute. And then there's a lot of information on the dietary laws there. And then there's other laws concerning leprosy, childbirth, all different kinds of things. And then, after chapter 16, as it carries on, there's more and more commands, statutes dealing with the sanctity of blood, moral laws, ceremonial laws, and all kinds of other laws. But right here in chapter 16, plopped right in the middle of all of this law-giving, God inspired Moses to concentrate on the expansion of his instructions, God's instructions, regarding one of his annual Sabbath days. It's not the first one, it's not Passover, it's not any of the early ones, but one of the later ones, and it's the one that deals with food, or the lack of it. And that's, of course, the Day of Atonement. And I asked myself, why was that? Why did God plop that in there? Why did he insert that right in there, just that one holy day, and start talking about that? Well, it seems that it was inserted there because of the recent sin of Nadab and Abihu, which was recorded back in chapter 10, in which they were guilty of defiling God's tabernacle. And of course, they paid the death penalty for doing so. God says, you do this, I'll do that. And they did that, God did that. And the accent, or part of the accent on this, all of the accents of this chapter 16, is that the Day of Atonement is the only day of the year that the high priest was permitted to enter the Holy of Holies. But also, it mentions in there, and I find it interesting, that it's the first mention of the Day of Atonement being called a Sabbath. It's called a Sabbath, and it's the first mention of it, of the requirement for fasting. So Leviticus chapter 16 and verse 31, I'm going to jump right in there on it. Leviticus chapter 16 and verse 31, it shall be a Sabbath of rest. Shabbat, Shabbathon, as we read earlier on. Shabbat, Shabbathon. Sabbath of rest unto you, and you shall afflict your souls by a statute forever. So, this is an extra special Sabbath day. This is a Shabbat, Shabbathon. And we understand that the afflicting of our souls, because many of us have been doing it for years, that it's total fasting for 24 hours, no food, no water, and virtually total rest. Absolutely no cooking, obviously, not even a minor level of food preparation that is permitted by God on the other Sabbaths and on the other holy days, again, which is alluded to in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 16. So, no food. We go hungry on that day? Yes, we do. For good reason. For that one day, yes, we go hungry on that day. And there's lessons that we can learn for our study from this. Now, we're just coming into the spring holy days. We've got more than 6 months left until we arrive at the Day of Atonement. So I'm not going to go into all of the symbolism of the fasting component of the Day of Atonement, but I only want to mention that although the Day of Atonement is a fast day, it's clearly and purposely listed in Leviticus 23 as a feast of the Lord, a feast of the Eternal. Part of the accent of the Day of Atonement is the consumption of spiritual food rather than physical food. And also look into the time in the world tomorrow when God's people will no longer be dependent on physical food. All of the other annual Sabbaths, all of the other weekly Sabbaths are feast days, physical feast days. Days for feasting. But does this accent on feasting mean that on the Sabbath day or on a holy day that there's an inherent automatic requirement for hot food? Does it mean that there's an inherent automatic requirement for cooking or for eating out in restaurants on God's weekly Sabbath days or annual Sabbath days? I'm asking these questions. You can say yes or no if you want. Is hot, freshly cooked food, I'm getting hungry talking about it, is hot, freshly cooked food absolutely, and that is an absolute necessity every day of the year? Again, other than the fast days, of course, and that's what we learn from the Day of Atonement. Or we have to beware, brethren, could it become a craving that we in our minds think that it's a necessity, and if we're not careful, we can almost tend to be led into even a level of lusting after these things, you know, thinking in our minds that, yeah, it's an absolute necessity, I've got to have hot food every day, and we start to somehow feel that a meal is not even a proper meal unless it's hot and freshly cooked. A meal is almost a hardship. It's almost like a semi-fast if it's not piping hot and freshly cooked. We can fall into that kind of mindset. So, again, we've got to look back to the mistakes that the Israelites made, and we've got to beware, brethren, of getting into similar murmuring attitudes of our Israelite forefathers. And we've got to beware of straying dangerously close to the line, the invisible line. And beware of disobedience. Again, remember those Israelites talking about all of the wonderful leeks and all of the garlic and all of the wonderful food that they had back in. I think they had selective memories.
Yes.
Maybe they did have all of those nice things, but... You know, we have to beware of getting into those murmuring attitudes. And again, I just think about the Feast of Pentecost last year. And I think we were up in England there, in Northern England. And I think of the banquet that we had. And it was all cold food, but it was absolutely wonderful. It was a feast. It was a true feast. Stomach's rumbling. Okay. But the thing is, brethren, God is not out to... He's not out to punish us. God wants to bless all of us who keep his Sabbath willingly and happily. He's not out to curse us or to test us beyond limits of our endurance. It's not his intention to punish those, again, who are sincerely striving to obey his laws. Okay, let's move on. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 19. Leviticus 19. And here, what we got here, brethren, is there's two mentions of the Sabbath here, and they're separated by 26 verses. But they're closely related in the subject matter. So these are, let's start with Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 3. And just look at some of the words that are similar to both verses here. One's chapter 3, the other one's verse 30. Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 3. You shall fear, and the Hebrew word is yar, which is Y-A-R-E. You shall fear every man his mother and his father, and keep, the Hebrew word is shamar, keep my Sabbaths. I am the Eternal, your God. That's verse 3. Now look at verse 30, and he starts off with, you shall keep, shamar, my Sabbaths, and reverence, yar, my sanctuary. I am the Eternal. You see the similarity between those two verses there, brethren? In verse 3, God gives us a repetition of two of his Ten Commandments. The fifth commandment with respecting our mums and dads, and the fourth with regards to keeping his Sabbaths. And then in verse 30, God ties together, links the keeping of the Sabbath with the reverencing of his sanctuary. And of course at that time it was the tent tabernacle. And at that time, the tent tabernacle, it was quite newly built, but it had already been defiled by Nadab and Abihu. So, although these two verses are separated by 26 other verses, they have some interesting and significant and relevant common factors. Both of the verses include commands that we must keep God's Sabbath, the word Shamar. In verse 3, the Eternal tells us that every man, not just children, not just little children, but adults too, if our mums and dads are still alive, of course, assuming that they're still alive, that we must, in a proper way, fear our mothers and fathers. And also, of course, that we must keep Shamar, God's Sabbath. In verse 30, the Eternal instructs his people to keep his Sabbath, Shamar, his Sabbath, and reverence his sanctuary. And again, reverence is the word Yah. It's exactly the same word that is translated fear in verse 3. And I believe that this is a double tie-in between the keeping of God's Sabbath, the proper fear of our parents, the reverencing of God's sanctuary. And I believe that this is significant, and the main ideas that come out of this are these, that just as the Israelites were to maintain a proper fear and respect and reverence for their parents, then they were also to maintain a similar and proper reverence for God's holy Sabbath day. In other words, they should have a proper fear not to profane God's Sabbath in any way. And secondly, just as the Israelites were to have a proper reverence for God's tent tabernacle, and later obviously for his stone temples, they also were to maintain a proper reverence for his holy Sabbaths, and again, a proper fear not to profane those Sabbaths. Let's just take a quick look at the Hebrew words here for keep. The words keep, fear, and reverence. And again, as they are related, as those words are related to the keeping of God's Sabbaths and holy days. And when I go through this, brethren, I want to ask you to apply these words, the English translation of the Hebrew words, to apply them in your own mind to the proper use of God's holy Sabbath time, and specifically with regards to the aspect of Sabbath food. Okay, now the word Shamar, the English word was keep, as far as the Sabbath was concerned, keep my Sabbaths. And the word keep in English, I find it's a somewhat weak and imprecise word. But the Hebrew verb Shamar, it's Strong's 08104, is also translated in the King James Version as these more solid and precise words. Listen to these, and again, apply them to your Sabbath observance. Heed, H-E-E-D, observe, preserve, beware, mark, wait, watch, regard, and save. And then the extended Hebrew meanings they're really fantastic as the scholars open up and embellish on the various words. These are descriptive terms of advice and commandments for the proper and reverential keeping of God's holy time. Listen to some of these, brethren. Celebrate. That's a good one. We all love to do that. Perform as with a vow. That's a good one too. I'm going to keep your Sabbaths holy, God. with a vow and make a promise that we're going to do that. We're going to strive to do that, to keep the Sabbath in the best way that we can. Restrain. Reserve. Beware of breaking. Keep oneself from breaking. Not breaking oneself, but obviously in this terminology, breaking the Sabbath. Refrain from breaking. Abstain from breaking. Guard. Be on one's guard. Protect. Are we protective of the Sabbath, brethren? Do we love it, and to the point where we feel protective of it? It's God's, but it belongs to us as well. Have charge of, take care of, keep watch over. Listen to these final ones here, brethren. Watch as would a watchman, as a watchman. We're like, standing on guard for God's holy Sabbath. Treasure. We treasure the Sabbath. Is it supremely valuable to us, brethren? And this is the last one. I love this one. Save like a life. Save like a life. I think that's a really fantastic one. Okay. And I ask the question, do these words describe your attitude towards God's precious Sabbath time? Or have some of our attitudes become a little lax? Just a little slack? Just a little liberal? Again, it's not for me to judge. It's for you to answer those questions in your own mind. Okay, the second word in common to verses 3 and verse 30 here is another verb, yar, Y-A-R-E, Strong's 03372. I have a zero in the front there, brethren. In my Strong's, it's got zeros in front of all of the Hebrew numbers, and in the New Testament, there's no zero in the front, and that just delineates it. Okay. Yah, translated in the King James Version as reverence, fear, fearful, afraid, listen to these two, terrible and dreadful. Now, of course, we shouldn't consider God's holy Sabbath time to be terrible or dreadful. I think maybe our kids did at one time, when they were little. In the modern concept of those words, terrible and dreadful, however, we certainly should have a proper fear and a proper dread of breaking or misusing God's Sabbath time. And the extended meanings of the Hebrew word yar can include, listen to these ones, make afraid, terrify, stand in awe of, cause astonishment and awe, inspire reverence or godly fear or awe, honor and respect. So again, I ask you the question to consider these things in your own heart and mind. Do you have a proper godly fear of defiling God's Sabbath time? Are you properly afraid in the right way, or even terrified of doing so, of defiling God's holy Sabbath? That man who was collecting the sticks, he wasn't. He treated it as nothing. Sabbath stuff. Yeah. These two verses, Leviticus 19, verses 3 and 30, again, they give strong but fair warning that if we are admittedly imperfect human beings, and if we must err in these things, we'd be far wiser, brethren, to err on the safe side. On the safe side. So in conclusion, brethren, I want to refer once again to our two core scriptures. You don't have to go back to them, but to burn them into your memory. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 16. Romans verses 14 and 23. Brethren, there's not going to be any minister, I'm certainly not going to do it, There's no ministers and there's no deacons with their black armbands or big sticks that they're going to be standing over you, watching you, to make sure that you do these things right, you know, that you're going to keep the Sabbath perfectly or correctly according to their definitions, you know, and according to somebody else's definition. What you do, brethren, and what I do is between you and Jesus Christ. He's our perfect, loving, righteous, and omniscient judge. Remember, he's omniscient. And make no mistake, brethren, and as I mentioned at the Feast of Tabernacles in the sermon last fall, he is watching us. And God the Father is watching us. They are watching us. They're watching what we choose to do. They're watching the decisions that we choose to make. And they're watching to see if we will obey their commands and how we will obey their commandments. So brethren, their loving care though and their oversight should not intimidate us. And rather, their loving care and oversight should encourage us and exhort us.